This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Howard Stern. And yeah, I know, we're kind of radio opposites. But we both do interviews, and in my opinion, his have gotten really good. He does a comedy show, but his interviews can go deep. He's collected some of his best in the new book, Howard Stern Comes Again. I guess the title had to have some kind of sexual reference. He's Howard Stern. But he's the 65-year-old Howard Stern, who's allowed himself to change over time and to move away from some of the crude sex talk and sexism of his earlier years, and in his interviews to emphasize empathy over outrageousness. But he admits that his show still contains a fair amount of what he describes as second-grade humor. After his show became nationally syndicated in 1986, its success, his subsequent books, and the movie adaptation of his memoir, Private Parts, led him to crown himself the king of all media. In 2005, Stern moved to satellite radio, where he didn't have to deal with the regulations of the FCC or the standards of local stations, and he was free to say anything. His show is so important to building a subscription base for Sirius XM, and he has such a devoted following that he was given two channels. We recorded our interview Friday. Howard Stern, welcome to Fresh Air. I am so excited this is happening. You know, like some of our listeners, I think just a few, but some of our listeners are outraged that Howard Stern's going to be on our show. And some of your listeners probably think, public radio is so incredibly boring. Why are you wasting your time on public radio?
No, I actually got a really great reaction when I said on my show that I'm coming on the Terry Gross show. Everyone was like, oh, she's the best interviewer in the world. To hear you two guys together, it's going to be awesome, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, this is great. So, I don't know about your listeners, but certainly mine, we seem to be pretty jacked up about it.
A lot of our listeners are, too. I just know some of them are like, what? but for those of
can
us—
Can I tell you one thing?
Yes.
This morning,
yeah.
I woke up.
Yeah.
And I said to my wife, I'm going on the Terry Gross show. I'm gonna go learn about her. And the first thing I learned was that you had written a book.
Yes.
And so, yeah, so I went on my Kindle account, you know, and here you have written a book on interviewing, which is why I'm here talking to you. And I went, oh, wow, I should have read this. So I on my Kindle, you get a little chapter for free, you know.
Yeah.
So I began reading it. And the first thing, like literally that you wrote is, hey, when I was writing a book about interviews, I didn't know if they'd be good to read because, you know, people have heard them on the radio. And that was my whole dilemma. That's why I almost didn't write the book. It was as if you were talking to me. And then I read a little further along, and you said something about when you interview people that you cut them off quickly if they're boring or going on too long. And then I got filled with dread because I don't know that I'm a really good interview, to be honest. And I go on. I'm verbose. So I said, oh, she's going to be cutting me off every minute. And when she cuts me off, my ego is going to be destroyed because I think I'm a pretty good broadcaster, but I don't know if I'm a good interviewer. So
it's funny because I was thinking, like, is Howard going to give long answers? And I thought, no, I mean, Howard knows what good radio is, so he's not going to go on too long. He knows exactly what timing is. But I so identified with your introduction in the book because you didn't want to do the book because you know how hard it is. And even books, when an editor promises you it's going to be simple, it's so hard. And one of the great things about doing a daily show is that it ends and you feel like, yeah, I did it. It's over.
Right.
I accomplished it. It's done. You know you got another show the next day, but you have this momentary feeling of like, it's over. And you never get that with a book until like years later.
I know. And this comes as a shock to me each time I write a book. For some reason, I think it's going to be easy. And when I agreed with Simon & Schuster that I'd go write a book about my best interviews or maybe so, you know, just sort of my philosophy on this, they said, you know, just write a little something before each interview and it'll be done in a few weeks and you'll be fine. And that is just not the case, certainly not with me. I labor over everything and it took me 2 years to write this book.
Exactly, but I'm really glad you did. So listen, I'm in a studio in Philadelphia. You're in a studio in New York.
I didn't know if you admitted that or not, so I didn't bring it up.
Oh, yeah. I usually don't get to see my guests because they're not in Philly, so we just connect via high-tech stuff.
But I was shocked in your book. The little part I read today, you said you like that, and I would dread that. That would be the worst thing in the world, not to look someone in the eye while I'm interviewing them. I don't think I'm not comfortable with that.
Oh, I'm surprised to hear that because, well, Let me describe your set a little bit, or maybe ask you to describe it. I mean, you're in a desk that almost looks like a barricade.
That's right.
You're on this big desk that has this like big, like almost half oval rim around it that really looks like you're barricaded in. And then your guest is like a bunch of feet away from you on a couch. And it's a pretty big distance. Like, it's not a distance you would typically sit from someone. You'd sit much closer if you were having a conversation that wasn't on the radio, if you're just talking to each other in a room. Why do you have it? Why do you have the barricade and the distance from your guest?
Well, that is really interesting that you say that, and I hadn't really considered it. Now, part of it is that I work my own equipment. And I say this in my book, that if anyone is serious about radio, that I think they should work their own equipment. They should learn how to run a board, as we say in radio. And I, for me, I'm such, maybe it's the control freak in me, but I like to control every microphone, the volume, the sound effects going on, whatever it might be. So all of that equipment in front of me and that big barricade has a lot to do with the physical equipment. I'm running the show. And while sometimes it's a pain in the neck and you wish you'd had some liberation from it, I think it's essential. But to tell you the truth, I had not really considered the distance between me and the guest. It actually felt pretty intimate and comfortable. Maybe being on top of each other would be too much.
Mm-hmm. So anyways, a question for you. Your interviewing approach has changed over the years. It's you go deeper, you have more empathy. And you've said when you think of the interviews you did during the first couple of decades on your show that you cringe. You say, I was an absolute maniac. My narcissism was so strong, I was incapable of appreciating what somebody else might be feeling. In your introduction to your interview with Gwyneth Paltrow in your book, you write that on terrestrial radio, my interviewing technique was like bashing someone in the face with a sledgehammer. I treated my guests as props. All I wanted was to cause chaos. And you've said that, you know, therapy was a turning point for you. You started therapy, what, 20 years ago? Is it too personal to ask you what the therapy approach is that you
No, not personal at all. I'm happy to talk about it, and I hope something that comes out of this book, that people aren't afraid of therapy. I think it is the most useful tool in the world. And I talk to people who are really uptight about it, and I understand that it took me 5 years before I called this guy that I go to see. And it's psychoanalysis. It's, I want to say it's more Freudian, but I don't get that sense. I don't lay on a couch, although he suggested that I do, but I was not comfortable with it. I couldn't get used to it. Even the thought of laying down on a couch and not being able to look at a person, speaking of what we just spoke about, I need to look a person in the eye, and I think it's my own insecurity. I'm afraid they'd fall asleep on me or they weren't really paying attention. I have a lot of issues. But psychoanalysis really did a big change for me. I didn't go there thinking that it would affect my radio show so much. I went there because, you know, I wanted to examine my relationships, how I related to the world and the people around me. And I felt that I was in a bit of a crisis having gone through a divorce. And with all of that going on, and I had three young children, so I really wanted to be the best father I could be. I had a lot of lofty ambitions.
So what kind of analysis is it? How does it work?
Well, what was so profound for me and why I signed on, I sat there with the psychoanalyst, the psychiatrist, and I said, I guess I'll tell you about myself. And I started to go into a fabulous routine that I'd done many times on the radio. I would start talking about my parents and complete with impressions. And I was like, you know, listen, my son, this is about my mother talking, my son was raised to please me. And then he knew how to behave. And I taught my son how to respect people. And I told him every day to dress like he was meeting the governor. And I'm going into these routines, and then I bring my father into it. I told you, you're very stupid. You're going to make $1 million on the radio. You don't even know how to speak properly. You don't even know how to speak properly. Why are you two yelling at each other? So I would start to do this routine, and I'm going into this elaborate thing, and he stops me. He stops me cold. looks at me and he says, I don't find any of this funny. Now, I was like, hey, what the hell is he talking about? What do you mean it's not funny? I get paid a lot of money to do this stuff. He goes, no, I find it rather sad. And why are you telling me stories? Why are you not talking to me about anything real? I had no clue what he was talking about. I had never sat alone in a room with any human being on this planet and been listened to in the way, in a real way. Everything with me was shtick and funny. And that's how my family related. We didn't sit and ask about feelings. This took me years to get used to. It wasn't like all of a sudden I had an epiphany. I was freaking out. I was like, man, I was like, this guy wants me to talk. What does he mean he doesn't want me to be funny? I'm funny. You know, it was just, it rocked my world. Now, you know, as I was going through therapy, I was also making a transition from terrestrial radio, commercial radio, to satellite radio. On satellite, they were giving me the time to do whatever I want. And Terry, I mean, by whatever I want, I had no government restrictions. I could be as dirty as I wanted to be. I could be as outrageous as I wanted to be. And I realized rather quickly, that's so boring on satellite radio. You have to rail against someone. All of the outrageousness that I was about was because the government hated it, religious groups hated it, and now suddenly, I'm in the Wild West. I can talk about anything I want. It's paid subscription radio. So with that, I started to not only get turned on by how I was being heard in that psychiatrist's office, but I began to contemplate what would really be interesting, now that I have this format, how about bringing in a guest here and there and really having a real conversation? And what that meant for me, and this was mind-blowing to me, not to you, but to me, what if I could let the other person shine? What if I could shut my big yap and not make it about me?
Was that hard for you, to not make it about you?
Oh, my God. The inner child, you know, look, the reason you quoted my book, the reason that this was so difficult, when I was on commercial radio, I couldn't allow a guest to even say five words in a row. I'm looking at the clock. I need high ratings. When you're doing an act like mine, you need high ratings. They're not keeping you around for the joy of it. They want to be number one because they're putting up with a lot of government fines, a lot of religious groups complaining, people complaining to get me off the air, so I had to deliver the goods. And so when a Robin Williams walked in or a Gilda Radner, people I love and adore, I'm like, I've got to keep this going. So I'm blurting out jackhammer-like questions. Robin Williams, I hear you having sex with your nanny. Gilda, what's it like to, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, the audience is cheering me on because it sounds outrageous and it sounds wild and it sounds like, oh, my God, did he just say that to Robin Williams? But there's no dialogue. I'm not learning anything.
Okay, so the therapist, you explain this in the book, that the therapist said to you that, you know, when you were telling him all these funny stories about your parents, what he heard was the sadness underneath the comedy.
Absolutely.
So when he pointed out the sadness in your comedy, had you not been aware of it before?
No.
And
I
also,
never let it touch me.
So when he, you know, like, underscored, hey, this sounds really sad. This is coming from unhappiness. Did it change your comedy in addition to changing your interviews?
Yeah, it did. It changed my whole perspective. Everything started to change. You know, I describe in the book that my policy was to be pure id and open and just let your brain dump every bit of feeling and information out. But mostly what would come out was anger. It wasn't fully dimensional, you know? And so, yes, in therapy, I began to explore other ways of communicating. And I think I'm the happiest I've ever been on the radio. And it's not to suggest that the radio show isn't completely insane still, which it is. There's a lot of outrageous humor in things. But what I also began to guard and protect are certain things in my personal life, that some things became precious and off limits. And so there became a better balance. And now I find it's more multidimensional, and I'm happier with it.
You had no boundaries earlier in your career when you were doing
zero.
You'd talk about anybody in your life, anything in your life, and you'd ask your guests about anything in their lives, their genital size, their sex lives, anything.
Right.
And it made a lot of people afraid to come on your show. Were there boundaries in your home when you were growing up?
That's a really good question. There were a lot of rules and regulations, but no real boundaries.
What were the rules and regulations?
Anything. Well, I was a very regimented kid. I mean, there were lots of rules about behavior and discipline and really probably not being allowed to really think for myself. You know, I was in the service of my parents. It's a strange thing what happens with trauma when you're young. You shut down if you want to self-protect. You know, I don't want to get all heavy here, but what happens is, in my opinion, I had a very strange upbringing, you know, and I grew up in eventually what became an all-black community, and I was one of a few white kids. And I never once said to my parents, gee, I'm feeling estranged here. All my friends have moved away. Sometimes I knock on my friend's door, and overnight they moved away, and I never saw them again. And all my friends are gone. But I would never go to my parents and say, gee, I'm having a hard time with this. There wasn't that kind of discussion. My feelings and my difficulties were not on the table. And so I buried them. And I think when I eventually got on the radio and I was roaring loud and certainly had everyone tuned into me, I couldn't get enough of it. There was a point in my career where we did research. One out of every four cars on the Long Island Expressway in the largest market in the United States, New York, were listening and tuned into me. And when I heard that, I just was massively depressed that three of those four cars were not listening to me.
Yeah, right.
And it's a staggering, you know, you want everything and nothing satisfies you and you only want to be in a narcissistic kind of way, the center of the universe and the focus. I was clearly a starved person who only would believe that the focus needed to be on me.
You use the word trauma when you survive trauma. What is specifically the trauma of your early years?
Well, I think it was the burying of emotion. It was certainly being in a lot of fights.
Verbal or physical?
Well, no, physical. Where I grew up, it was a very difficult time. Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And when you live in an all-black community, I was the victim of a lot of anguish and anger. And it was a very, very difficult time in my life. And when I say trauma, I don't think I recovered from it. I went off to college. I felt very unprepared. I felt very everything was difficult. I don't know where I found the strength to actually go on the radio and pull this whole career off. There was a lot of shyness on my part. But when I got behind the microphone, I just always thought that would be my salvation. And I realize now, you know, my father was a radio engineer, and he looked at those broadcasters with such reverence. He was so kind and loving toward them and worshiped them. I said, aha, so that's what you do. You get behind a microphone and you get everyone listening and then everyone loves you. Well, that's a sad way to live your life because nobody really genuinely loves you. They appreciate what you do and they appreciate the entertainment you give them, but that's not the kind of love I was looking for.
So what was the worst physical beating that you took?
Well, I could point. I have a greatest hits coming out of that. Greatest beatings I ever took. But I remember one specifically, and there were some tough guys there, and I can tell you one that really sticks out in my mind. This one guy who was about 2 years older than me. He was in my grade, but he was 2 years older than me. He already had facial hair. He was taller than I was and very strong, a very good fighter. He expected me to give him money every day, try to shake me down for money. And it was getting really bad. I finally complained that my mother went to the dean of boys. Big mistake. We had a dean of boys. They were trying a new approach to get the kids under control. Well, the dean of boys dragged this guy in who was trying to shake me down. And he didn't give my name, but he said, someone has complained about you and you're in big trouble. Well, he hunted me down. Mm. He figured it was either me. So he confronted me in a shop class. I just remember this guy said, did you, mob style, did you squeal on me? I said, no, I didn't. It wasn't me. And I was getting nervous. I was like, oh, he knows, but I better just keep sticking to my story. I have to stick to my story. Did you tell? And then he grabbed me around the neck and began to squeeze, and the air was going out of my thing, and I'm struggling. And Roosevelt, you fight back. Even if you're not a great fighter, you mm-hmm. fight back.
Mm-hmm.
You must fight. And so I remember thinking, I'm going to pass out here. This could be it. I don't know what's happening. But then he let go. He goes, all right, I believe you. And then he left. But oddly enough, it wasn't only black-on-white violence. It was white-on-white violence. The few white kids who were there, I remember there was a guy who sat in front of me.
They hated you too?
Yeah, I was universally hated and despised, I guess.
Was talking a weapon for you? I mean, you're so funny. And you're
I shut down.
Like, you're so verbally
agile.
You didn't talk at all?
No. No. In fact, when I went to this white community, I was even more out of my element. I was completely inhibited. I remember I took a class in psychology senior year. I couldn't talk to any of the kids there. I had a few friends, but nothing great. And I was just out of it. And more alone than ever. I couldn't relate to these white kids. I couldn't. I was just whacked out from the whole thing. And so I remember being in the psychology class. I refused to talk. The teacher called me in afterwards and said, you have to talk in my class or I'm going to flunk you. I said to her, I can't. She goes, well, then I'm going to flunk you. Here she's a psychologist. You should have said, well, why not? You know, but okay. So she said, I'm going to flunk you. And I couldn't talk. She said, you have to get an A on the final project. If you're going to, this is interesting, actually. And I wish I'd put this in the book. So I had to get out of school. I mean, it was my senior year. I just wanted to graduate. I didn't like being there at all. So I panicked. And you know what I did? I went and interviewed on tape my cousin who was in psychotherapy and on several drugs to treat it. And I did an hour and a half interview with my cousin Jack. And she played it in class. Turned to me, she said, this is the greatest project I've ever heard. I'm giving you an A. Can I own this record so I can play it for future classes? You know, I hadn't made that correlation. Maybe that was the first interview I ever did. It was my cousin. And he got me an A.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, that's pretty crazy, isn't it?
So I have to ask you about this. So much of your show over the years, especially earlier in your career, has been about sex in ways that have been interesting and enlightening and ways that seemed really kind of gross or intrusive or, you know, just sexist. So I want to ask you just a couple of things about that. So you told Jonah Hill in an interview that you envied young men who can have women as friends and not just want to have sex with them. And you mm-hmm. said that's something you had to learn later in life. So how much later?
A lot later.
Uh-huh.
You know, I always had friends, women friends, growing up, but it wasn't by choice. Nobody wanted to have sex with me. But no, I really did have friendships with women, and some of my best working relationships have been with women.
Well,
in
Robin.
Fact, well, Robin for sure. Fran Shea of the E! Network, who gave me my first interview show. Denise Oliver, who was my program director, who put Robin and I together. And yet there's this, as you say, on my radio show, there was so much sex and so much wild behavior. And in my mind, I was also a guy, you know, listen, I was in my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, and this was all fascinating to me. But what was really great about it was like punk rock. It was like, what can I do that will freak everyone out? Oh, everyone's uptight about sex. Sex, sex, sex. Now, in my family, my mother got me a subscription to Playboy at 13, and she sat me down and said, I want you to know something. First of all, real women don't look like this. These women in Playboy are freaks. No one looks like that. They look more like me and your sister and your aunt and all these women. And you can have Playboy, and I don't care. You want to talk about sex, you want to show your friends, blah, blah, blah. I don't care. But just keep in mind, there's no reality to this. So, in a sense, my friends, their parents wouldn't even mention sex. And to me, going on The Tonight Show and talking about lesbianism, bringing out two lesbians and having Jay Leno walk out, or having these hypocritical religious jerks who raise money, you know, ripping people off, telling them all kinds of garbage, And what's the one thing they can't handle? Sex. Sex, sex, sex. I wanted to decriminalize sex. I wanted to go on and celebrate sex and say, who cares? We're talking about sex. We're all animals and we all have sex.
Okay, so I really like the idea of celebrating sex. The part I didn't like about your show was talking about the size of women's breasts and how much you'd like to have sex with them and rating women 1 to 10
right.
or asking
right.
guests to. And you had such a large following of young men. And I'm specifically referring here to like the 90s, the early aughts.
Yes.
It's like you were teaching young men how to leer at women and be really crude and judge women according to their breast size. And that always really troubled me. And I know you cringe about a lot of things when you look back at your early career. Do you cringe
Yes.
about that?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, in one sense, I could get defensive and tell you that we would also do this to men. It wasn't just, it was a show that was super judgmental and, you know, again, unleashed it. My evaluation was, hey, I am not going to hide what men are really thinking. This was my thinking back then. I am not going to hide what men are thinking. I'm not going to BS the women in my audience. By the way, my audience is 40% female. So that might shock you, but it was like, let women hear what real guys sound like. Now, this was my thinking. I didn't know that isn't what real guys think. This is what my perception was. So I thought I was performing a public service. Now, I mean, I thought I was like, hey, the guys are jerks and you need to know it. But hey, I'm a jerk too. And I was a jerk.
Yeah, but I felt like you were going like, and I'm a, you know, this is how, if you want to be cool, if you want to be like Howard Stern, this is
right.
how you treat
this
women.
This is how you
this
behave.
This is how you
yeah.
talk to women. And that I found
right.
that really upsetting.
I don't think I had the wherewithal to really analyze it.
Uh-huh.
I just was doing my thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as I got older and wiser, I started to look at that. And I said, well, it troubles me. That's not who I am anymore. I don't really care about any of that. And it's not to say I wouldn't be on the radio today commenting on somebody who wore an outrageous outfit to the Met Gala or something, but it's done in a different way with a different approach, and a lot of that stuff I can't stand now. It's too harsh. And if I hadn't changed, if I had become a 65-year-old guy fawning over women, it would have been pathetic and sad. My audience would have aged out.
Tell me more about what changed you.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, and number one, psychotherapy. When I entered psychotherapy, and now I was divorced, I thought, I could have any woman I want. This is extreme narcissism. I'm famous. I can have everything in the world is mine. The world is my oyster. I'm the center of attention. This is what I went in with. And so psychotherapy, I began a process of really becoming empathic with people. And empathic with my daughters, and empathic with my wife. When I met Beth, that was a huge game changer for me. It was, first of all, I realized I'm not some kind of crazy playboy. I wanted a loving, monogamous relationship, and I didn't want to screw it up. How was I going to pull that off if I'm this crazy guy who's sitting and thinking about breast size and all that other stuff? There's a complete disconnect here.
Well, how did you pull it off in your first marriage? You were married for 25
My marriage didn't go well.
Uh-huh.
Let's be honest. It ended in divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had many, many good years, but ultimately it failed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know, I wasn't a cheater. I wasn't anything like that. I really was committed and had a sense of morality and with all of that. But yet, I was a confused guy. I'd never been given lessons on how to be a man.
I always wonder what it was like for your wife, for your first wife, when you were on the air doing all
this. I'm sure it was
stuff.
Difficult.
Yeah.
And by the way, I can't imagine anyone having been married or in a friendship or relationship with me back then. I was singularly focused on my career and petrified that I wasn't going to be able to make a living. And even all the sexual antics, the religious antics, the race antics, everything that I talked about, every outrageous thing that I did was to entertain my audience and grow my audience. That's all I was focused on. I wasn't putting that much thought. I said, unleash the id, be open and honest, and let it fly, baby. And that's where I was at. And whether you liked it or not, or the person down the street liked it or not, I didn't care as long as I kept growing that audience. And I knew, and quite frankly, I thought, oh my God, I'm doing the greatest radio of all time. Everyone should be tuned in. But I wasn't. And then it's ridiculous to think that everyone's going to enjoy my radio show. So you can see the whole thing was a fantasy. You know, if I hadn't grown and evolved and changed and really had a profound kind of new approach to radio, I don't know that I could still be on the radio. And I don't know that that would be interesting to my audience. I think where I'm at now is the perfect place.
I think it's interesting that you're talking about changing as you get older. I think there's an impulse a lot of people have that if they change as they're getting older, they're giving in to getting old, and old is bad. So they should hang on to everything from their youth because that means that they're young and they're not aging out of everything. So I like that you're embracing
This whole book is about change.
Yeah,
It's a complete, and it's not a revolution, it's an evolution.
So another question that kind of relates to this, in your interview with Amy Poehler, she talks about how she thinks like pornography can be desensitizing, that it is desensitizing. And you kind of agree with her.
Yep.
And so I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, about how you think pornography is desensitizing, and more specifically, was it desensitizing for you?
It scares the hell out of me, pornography. But let's be candid, I still watch pornography 2 or 3 times a week, so this might sound hypocritical. But at the same time, I worry, quite frankly, that it is desensitizing. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a kid now growing up with access to, you know, U-porn and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my God, how could you ever have a normal sex life when you watch that stuff? And in a way, I never learned about sex. No one taught me about sex. No one spoke to me about sex. And in a way, I fumbled around like many of us do and kind of figured stuff out. If I had had an instruction manual like pornography, probably my first sexual experience, I mean, I don't know what I would have been doing. I don't know what I would have expected and what kind of presentation I would have expected from a woman, and a presentation that I was making. And oh, my God, I don't know what the hell pornography is doing to our culture. But I'll defend it to the end. Look, mm-hmm. I'm not comfortable with censorship. I do wish kids were a little more innocent now. It really has to be doing something. So, you know, I'm not someone who's for regulation, but good Lord, I don't know. There's no governor on the thing, you know? It's crazy.
Did you look at porn before having sex for the first time, and was real sex disappointing compared to the expectations from porn?
Listen, I'm 65. There was no porn back then. I had one stag film that somebody gave
me. Did people have socks on?
yes. And the woman was wearing a fur coat, and there was a refrigerator repairman involved. It was ridiculous. But nevertheless, I saw that. And, you know, my father had a Super 8 millimeter. I had to wait for them to leave the house, my parents and my sister. I had to go down to the basement. I had to get the Super 8 rigged. And then I would watch this thing, and I was so nervous they were going to come back home. I would say, let me memorize this, and then maybe I'll go think about it. You know, back then, it was as innocent as watching Gilligan's Island and waiting for a moment when Tina Louise would come on or something. So, you know, New York Times girdle ads were my pornography. So, you know, when I first started to see pornography, I was like, oh, my God. I would go to movie theaters to see pornography when I got older. I had a fake ID. I was so stupid. All of my friends had the same fake birth certificate. It all said we were 18 years old. Now, if you were going to a movie theater to get into an X-rated film, wouldn't you present your driver's license? We'd go up with our birth certificate. And we all had the same name. And stupid me would be the last guy. I would sit on the curb while they went in to watch pornography. And I had to sit outside because by the third guy, the guy would go, hey, look, you all have the same name. Get out of here. So you know, that way it was so much more innocent. If you saw pornography, it was for a fleeting second. And I don't know. But is it healthier? I I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know. But I somehow think maybe that innocence was a good thing. I wasn't so charged up sexually. And then sometimes I think, well, maybe if I'd been exposed to pornography, who knows? Maybe even I wouldn't have gotten married so young. Is that convoluted in the sense that I was just like, oh, I guess you get married and you have sex. And, you know, it was like, I don't know, up was down and down was up. But I just know it troubles me that a 13-year-old boy or girl, they're checking out like really hardcore porn.
Yeah.
And expecting that. And, you know, what I've learned, and again, through psychotherapy and from being in a terrific marriage with my wife, Beth, that I really am a monogamous person. But you know what? I'm proud of myself for one reason. I worked on myself. I did something that a lot of people aren't willing to do. I go to therapy. Would I rather be out playing chess or painting or even just sitting and watching a television show than walking into that room and confronting my demons? I'd rather be doing anything else.
So we were talking about your father being a radio engineer who co-owned his own studio, and cartoons
yes.
and commercials, jingles were recorded there. Mm-hmm. I want to play something that was recorded there when you were a kid, because you used to go to the studio with your father sometimes. And this will give everybody a sense of what you were hearing as a kid. So this is a clip from the history of Howard Stern, like an audio documentary. So a DVD had been released of one of the cartoons that your father recorded audio for, and it was called Tennessee Tuxedo. I'll confess, I'd never heard of it.
Wow. It's a huge part of my life.
Yeah, okay. So the DVD had extras in it, and one of the extras has your father recording the theme, and you hear his voice slating the theme at the beginning of this recording.
Want to try one?
Why not?
Stand by. This is 30-second opening, take two.
1, 2, 3. Come on and see Tennessee Tuxedo.
Okay, that's it. Kind of
makes me sad.
Yeah. So, what was wonderful?
My father's 96 years old
uh-huh,
now,
uh-huh.
And my dad used to be on the show a lot, and to hear him as a young man doing that, you know, it's hard for me because he's lost a lot of ability.
Right.
And it wrecks me, really does. And Tennessee Tuxedo was magical for me in the sense that once a year my mother would force my father to take me to work with him. I don't think he particularly wanted me there. I think I was a big pain in the ass to him. But I would go there, and I was just mesmerized by what my father did. He was a radio engineer that transitioned to owning a recording studio with four other guys. At one point, it was five guys. It was a team. And they had a successful studio called Aura Recording, and they did a lot of recording of cartoons. And back then, the way they made cartoons, they don't do it this way anymore, but all of the actors, the voice actors on Tennessee Tuxedo would be lined up in a room all working together. And my father would like kind of throw me in the recording area and let me sit there. If I say, you know, he'd say, sit quiet, and he would let me watch what would happen. And again, you know, it was Don Adams, Get Smart from TV, Larry Storch from F Troop.
And he was like a Borschtfeld comic too, wasn't he?
Oh, my God, yes. And Larry Storch was, and these guys all did Tennessee Tuxedo. And it was like, you know, and Don Adams would stand there and go, Tennessee Tuxedo, oh, Mr. Whoopi. And he would do these voices and they would crack each other up. And the way my father looked at them, the way he was so reverential and he was so, if my father could look at me like that, I got to get behind that microphone. Now, this didn't all play out like a light bulb went over my head. I realize now that's what was going on. You know, for years I was in denial. I was like, I don't know why I got in radio. I had nothing to do with my father. I mean, it's a ridiculous statement, but that's how closed off I was.
How old were you the first time you heard your voice recorded, and how did it sound to you when it was played back?
I was very young. My father would, once a year, again, we would go down, the family would go to his recording studio. And, you know, back then you didn't even have VHS recording or anything. So to go and have your voice recorded at a young age was a big deal.
It was huge, yeah.
Huge. And so I would go there, and I was a little kid. I mean, we played tapes of it on the air. I don't know. Maybe I was 5, 6, something like that. And I remember my father would put me in front of the microphone, and then I would sing. Well, I was singing Jelly Beaner, which was a local kid show. So I must have been 5 or 6.
Oh, Jelly Beaner, Jelly Beaner, Jelly Beaner, Jelly Beaner, one and all.
Yeah, Jelly Beaner, Jelly Beaner. But I was a little kid, and I go, I just want to sing Jelly Beaner. And, you know, and I was crying and whining in the microphone. And then my sister would get to perform, and I would be recorded. And as I got older, I got to go down there, and I would do impressions of Soupy Sales. I was like, oh, I'm going to be like Soupy,
oh,
and I'd bring
Soupy,
my friends
yeah.
down.
Was it traumatic for you when your voice changed during puberty?
Yeah, you know, I was very uptight about my voice because, again, I had this fantasy that I was going to be on the radio. When I was 16, I used to write to this, I had a very, I thought I had a serious girlfriend. She describes it as, I thought we were just hanging out, but I was in love with her. And I would write her letters all the time, you know. I would have loved to have had, like, email and stuff, but we have to send letters. And I wouldn't dare use my father's phone because, my God, what a phone call would cost to the Bronx was ridiculous from Long Island. So I would write her these love letters and say, you know, I'm going to be this huge radio star and I'm going to be super famous. I was like trying to point out to her that she should really be into me. And I was using my, you know, my future
Your
career.
Future fame.
Yeah. And she actually came on our show and read these letters on the air. I sounded like such a douche. But, you know, to me, when my voice changed, there were times that it was deep when I was relaxed. Because don't forget, if I was going to get a radio job, I couldn't sound, you know, you had to have a certain sound, especially back then, to do rock radio and, you know, you had to have a professional sound. And so when my voice changed, it was okay, but I had a thick New York accent, very thick New York accent. And my voice was somewhere in here, like, you know, I'd get uptight, or if my voice got tired, I kind of sounded like Kermit the Frog. and when I got on the radio and I was nervous, when I first went down to a college radio station where I got on WRNW in Westchester, and even all the way through to D.C., D.C. 101, where my ratings really started kicking, my voice was very tight. And it would be like, you know, hi, this is Howard Stern. And I was like, I don't sound like a guy on the radio. And then I remember at some point, I even started to talk like this because it would loosen up my voice. And people were like, oh, yeah. And, like, people hear my old tapes and they go, what the, were you on helium? You know, what were you doing? But I was just trying to relax and get loose. And so, you know, I was so jealous when I worked at NBC of those, you know, those deep voice announcer guys. Oh, my God. But now I realize that was my key to actually sounding like someone in the audience. Thank God I didn't sound like one of those deep voice guys because I probably would have gotten real lazy and just gone and done voiceover work as opposed to doing what I ended up doing, which was way more satisfying. I did not want to be playing music on the radio. I didn't want to play the Beatles. I wanted to be the Beatles.
So we were talking
Could
about...
Could I say something?
Yes.
I love when you say Howard Stern comes again. I'll tell you what.
Tell me
I
what.
I wanted to write a really good book that
Where
that
I could
people...
say the title and it would have two meanings.
Well, in a way, yes, it definitely has two meanings, possibly three. But what's really interesting to me is that somehow I didn't want it to imply in the book that somehow the whole show has changed and you're going to tune in and you're going to hear, you know, this serious broadcast that blah, blah, blah. We still employ tons of second grade humor. And Howard Stern comes again as such a juvenile title. I wanted to make sure we got that in there. So and nothing pleases me more to hear on NPR Howard Stern comes again.
OK, so what you just said, how does it feel to be doing second grade humor, as you just called it, when you're 65?
I thought maybe I'd grow out of it, but I haven't. I still love fart humor. You know, I was Fart Man on MTV. I love...
Do you know I have trouble saying that word? Like, I find it so interesting that you played this character, Fart Man, and I have trouble just even saying the word. I don't know.
Well, why is that?
I don't know.
Why?
I ask myself that all the time. The whole thing's embarrassing. You know? Yeah.
Well, that's what I loved about it, because it is embarrassing. And to my great shame, even to this day, I can't look at the old pictures of me as far. Man, my belly's hanging out. My cellulite. My tuchus is so filled with cellulite. What was I thinking? You know what I mean? But yet, MTV played that over and over again for years and years. And I, you know, that's the thing. I let it all hang out. And I always made myself the brunt of humor, too. I think that's important. And I think even to this day, the reason people relax with me when I do these interviews in the book and on the radio, they know that I'm willing to go there, too. They know I'm willing to discuss the small size of my penis. They know I'm willing to be fart man and let my buttocks be out there with the cellulite. You know, I remember the look of disgust that people had for me when they saw that buttocks. Not good. But I still love phony phone calls. We are the major manufacturer at SiriusXM.
That's right.
Of phony phone calls.
Well, you know, as somebody in radio, one of the things that I found so kind of educational about your show is that it was people just talking to each other, like you and your regulars, you know, Robin and Gary and Fred and the whole crew, just talking to each other about sometimes really trivial things, kind of like office gossip, but you were talking in your own voices. And of course, you're all really smart and funny, so it was like lively and interesting, but it showed that you can make anything interesting if you're interesting enough in telling it. And if you were just sounded like people talking to each other, it could be really gripping, as opposed to sounding like announcers or like scripted.
Well, that's the weird thing. Back then, people weren't doing that on the radio, which was that was the real revolution, people talking like people. And, you know, it's funny, having written this new book as an interview book, people say, well, what are you most proud of on the radio? Well, yeah, I guess I'm most proud of the interviews. I like how it's presented in the book and all that. But really, there are days for me with the radio show, and now we put the show on 3 days a week, I'll turn to my people and say, you know, all the people who work with me, and I'll say, look, for the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks, don't have any guests. I need to groove. Meaning, I still think my audience appreciates the most to this day when I walk in, and yeah, I have an agenda, kind of, but I let things unfold. And it just morphs into this great kind of experience where you're sitting in a room with your friends and being funny. And I have to tell you, the days I know I have a guest coming in, I have knots in my stomach sometimes, because I know I'm not going to be doing that thing, that groove.
Well, you talk with Jerry Seinfeld in one of your interviews about how he and you are always constantly thinking in your head, how do I make what's happening now funny for the show or for stage?
Yeah.
You know, so that means, I think, that you're always removing yourself from the situation. I mean, that's basically what Jerry Seinfeld says. It's actually what you point out to him, I think, that if you're doing that, you have like one part of yourself in the world, in the moment, and the other part analyzing it and thinking, how do I make this funny tomorrow?
Yeah, Jerry and I have a fundamental disagreement about this. My whole life has been walking around, and sometimes I'm really there, but most times I'm mining some situation for radio. And, and my methodology for doing that is when it hits me, you know, I always have a pad and a pen around. And when it hits me, I then write to one of my producers, Jason Kaplan, and I go, notes for air. And I quickly get this stuff down and I start to develop what it is I want to talk about. But as I describe in the book, I'm never fully in the moment. And when I point it out to Jerry, Jerry goes, oh, I'm never in the moment. I'm always mining for material. But I said, isn't that terrible? He goes, no, I don't care. I love it. He has no problem with it whatsoever. And I say to him, how can that not affect your life? How does it not affect your relationship with your kids and your wife? And he goes, no, you know, he's fine with that balance or lack of balance. I know it affected my life and not always in a good way. And I had to learn more balance. I have to tune it out sometimes because I'm telling you, I don't know if this is true of you, Terry, but I have a radio show going on in my head all the time. All the time. I hear it all the time, and I just quickly write it down, and then I go and do it on the air.
So what's going through your mind right now?
Well, I mean, I'm focused on what we're doing, but, and I know when it'll hit me. I'll leave here, I'll go home, I do transcendental meditation. I'll be doing it. I'll be getting into it. And that show is going to start working its way into my head.
I'm glad you brought up TM, because you've been meditating since you were 18.
Right.
You explained that your mother taught you.
And it was a profound change with my mother that got me into it. My mother was a depressed woman, suicidal. She had a horrible life, terrible, terrible life. Lost her mother at 9, was sent away from home. Her father sent her to try to put her in an orphanage. The orphanage was filled, so he found a family to stick them with. It was her and her sister. It was a real saga, really, really bad. And, you know, listen, I was raised by a traumatized woman. She had terrible, terrible trauma. And overcame a lot in her life, but she became very sad when her sister died, who was really her only family. And she was in her 40s. And I'd come home from school, and my mother was just distraught. Didn't know what to do with her. I'd come home from school, and she'd be sobbing. I'm going to go upstairs. I'm going to kill myself. And my father would even say to her, how can we cheer you up? He says, I tell you what, I'll become an alcoholic with you. I understand alcoholics get rid of the... He didn't even know what to say. He would have become an alcoholic for the woman. My parents are very close to one another. And he was saying, I'll do anything, but nothing worked. And I went off to college, and I was worried about her, but she called me on the phone one day. And, like, all of a sudden, I'm talking to, the cheeriest, sounded like a Miss America pageant winner or something. You know, hi, how you doing? I'm like, who the hell is this? And she told me she saw the Maharishi on the Johnny Carson show. And she went to a TM meeting. And I'm telling you, this was profound change. You can't change like that. And she had tried medication. She had even tried psychotherapy. None of it appealed to her. But this did, and it worked. So I said, how could I not do this? And I'm glad I did.
You know, your mother was, or maybe was, suicidal. Did you ever feel that way yourself?
I hesitate to say that, but I was pretty down. I've been pretty depressed in my life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And most of that occurred at the time that my marriage fell apart.
Right.
And, it was tough and I was lost. And that's when psychotherapy came into my life.
Right. What was it like to have a mother who put the idea of suicide on the table? Do you know what I mean?
Because in my family, words meant nothing, we didn't have real serious conversation. I thought it was all kind of maybe just for drama.
Yeah.
I didn't know how real it was. Again, everything in my family seemed that the real conversation, sex we could talk about, race we could talk about, homosexuality we could talk about, you name it, we could talk about it. But it was always in a joking way. We could talk about the news of the day in a joking way. But to really address something in a serious way, that was difficult.
I want to play an example of how you draw on your life for your interviews. So what we've just been talking about, your mother's depression, her need to be cheered up, this comes into play in one of my favorite moments of your interviews, and this is with Stephen Colbert from 2015. And you're talking to him about how he lost his father and two of his siblings, two brothers, in a plane crash. And I forget how old he was, 9 maybe? I forget his age.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And so you're asking him about that and what it was like for his mother. So I just want to play a short excerpt of that.
Sure.
How did it change your mother? Was she able to have a strong face in front of you, or would she break down a lot?
Both. A little mix of everything. There's no clean description of what life was like.
Is it difficult for you to be around a crying woman now because of your mother?
Wow, that's deep, man.
Well, seriously.
Yeah, deep, Howard. You're getting deep. No, seriously, that's a very deep question, Howard.
But when women are difficult, because your mom had to be difficult. She was going through a crisis.
Not difficult, but,
upset.
I think there's no doubt that I do what I do because I wanted to make her happy.
You're
no
used
doubt.
To cheering up a woman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know of this.
Did you cry?
Really? Did you cheer up? What?
Were you able to cry?
No, not publicly. Wait a second.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you know to ask that question?
Because I spent many years cheering up your mother as well. I didn't want to tell you this. No. What happened? My mother lost her mother when she was 9. And my mother became very depressed when her sister died. And I spent a lot of years trying to cheer up my mother. And I became quite proficient at making her laugh and doing impressions and doing impressions of all the people in the neighborhood. It made her feel high. So I wonder, And even to this day, when I see a woman in distress, I feel like I have to jump in and solve her problem.
That's not a bad impulse, though.
Well, it certainly makes for a career. But I mean,
I just love hearing how stunned Colbert is when you ask him about, you know, having to cheer up his mother, and if it's hard for him to see women cry because his mother had cried so
well
much.
I love that moment. I'm so glad you pulled it, because I'm proud of that moment, because only someone who had to cheer up a mother would know to ask that question.
Exactly.
And, you know, again, I've explored the fact that this is a terrible burden on a kid to have to cheer up a mother. I remember doing, you know, very, very elaborate impressions of all the mothers in the neighborhood. And what I was doing is, not only was I doing impressions of them, but I was also ripping them apart. And my mother loved it, because what it meant was she was the best mother. It meant that when I would sit there and make fun of these other mothers, it meant not only was it funny, and not only did it make her cheered up, but what was really cheering her up was, you see, I'm the best mother. And I knew that on some level. Now, that's too much for a kid to know. So when Colbert, I had to go there with Colbert, and I think what really shocked him is, well, wait a second, here's Fart Man, and all of a sudden, maybe there's something a little deeper behind Fart Man, you know? This guy gets me. And so that's a real moment.
I have a question for you about confronting demons. Mm-hmm. You've talked about in several of your interviews about weed and how you can't smoke it because it makes you paranoid. And you also say in the book that you think LSD triggered your OCD, your obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah.
What are your OCD
rituals?
I took
too much. Oh, my God. When I really suffered badly from it, and I still do to a degree, but it's not as bad. But it was magical thinking. It would be... Let's say I was listening to your radio show, and I would be, oh my God, I have to be better than her. So I would tap on the radio three times above the speaker so that I was better than you. Or like this, it's magical thinking to think that it was my attempt to control the world. And so, you know, this became a thing with me and I don't know how it crept up on me. But I would find myself sometimes for like an hour kind of caught up in these rituals. And now I realize they were all about control.
So you've talked on the air recently, too, about the idea of retiring. But you're so obsessive about work. Do you worry about how your OCD would respond if there wasn't work to focus on? What would you be obsessing on if you're not obsessing on your show?
Yeah, I'm kind of afraid of retirement, and then all it is, I think about it and I want it. It's like on any given day, I don't know. And this disturbs me that I don't know myself well enough, that my contract is up in 2 years with Sirius XM, and I don't really know what it is I want and what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I know for the next 2 years I'm going to be doing this show. And this show provides me with a lot, and especially on those days that I'm just riffing on the radio and I'm getting out my thoughts and I'm able to make people laugh. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, no matter what I did in my career, no matter what you might think of me, I wanted an audience to love me and to laugh along with me and have a great ride and be just part of a scene that just was a lot of fun. That was my intent, to entertain. And so if I walk away from that, what would that look like? You know, I woke up the other day, I was angry about something. I can't even tell you what it was. But I had a whole point of view, and I said, "Oh, I got the show today. I'm gonna go do a whole bunch of material on this." That's a tremendous outlet. Now, if that's gone, you know, my poor wife, is she gonna sit there and listen to me rant and rave and carry on? You know, she's gonna probably quiet me down. So, I don't know. I don't know what it would look like without that. But at some point, I have to hang it up.
One of the things you reveal in your book is that the big sick day that you took, you know, you actually had a really big health scare. You'd had low white blood cell count that turned out to be from eating too much fish and having too much mercury in your system. Less fish, better blood cell count. But in the process of checking all that out, you had a body scan and there's a little shadow on your kidney. So you had to check that out and have exploratory surgery. Everything was fine. But it gave you a lot of chance to contemplate, like, what if it wasn't fine? What if you had cancer? What if the end was near? I mean, it was a cyst. Took a year to recover from the surgery and really feel like you'd fully gotten back to yourself. So do you feel like that made you think more about, like, gee, what if I were dying? Like, what am I really afraid of or not afraid of about what that would mean?
Oh, my God. That's why I wrote the book. I did not react well being told by a doctor that 95% chance you have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I freaked out. And you want to know how unrealistic, again, and unprepared I am for life. I somehow assume, because my parents are 96 and 91 and have experienced very good health, that I'm entitled to this, that nothing bad should happen to me, which is, again, a ridiculous notion. But, man, if that doesn't rock your reality and get you into a frame of mind where, like, wow, how much time do I have left? And what is it I'm really trying to accomplish with that time?
Are you afraid about death or afraid about suffering before death?
I think now it's more about the suffering before death. Boy, are we dark today, huh?
Yeah. You know, I think you are really dark.
I am.
That beneath all your humor is, like your therapist said, beneath your humor is sadness. And I think beneath your humor is a lot of real darkness. And I think that's part of what a lot of us respond to. It's not just like the shock of what you're saying. It's like the darkness and how deep you go with that darkness in plumbing your own depths.
That's what I think people like in terms of, and that's what I was trying to describe to you with trying to unleash your id, whether mm-hmm. it's about women or about, myself and myself in terms of my own image or whatever, or the experiences I've had in my life where people are just, you know, mean and downright, you know, whatever it is. There is that darkness. I mean, you should interview my wife. I mean, she can tell you what it's like to live with me. It's not yeah. It's not a picnic.
With you and a lot of cats.
Oh, my God. My wife is the opposite of me. She is light and bright. There's like a glow in the room. And I love her for being such a bright light. But I am dark. And I think what audiences responded to is that I was willing to unlock it mm-hmm. in front of them and pull my pants down, so to speak, and show it to them.
Well, kind of almost literally.
I did it literally, although not all the way.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to let you go because I know you got to go. It's been really, really wonderful to talk with you. I want to thank you for staying in radio all these years and not using radio just as a stepping stone to TV or movies. You've turned down so many offers and you've stayed in radio. You've done a lot of like kind of pioneering work in radio. And thank you as a radio person. Thank you for staying in radio and for acknowledging like the greatness of radio.
I love radio. Radio is the best. And that's it. We'll end on that. Radio is great.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
I think you're a terrific interviewer. And thank you for giving me access to your audience, which, like I said, that's a good audience.
My interview with Howard Stern was recorded Friday. If you missed part one of the interview, which we broadcast yesterday, you can listen on our podcast. Howard Stern's new book of interviews is called Howard Stern Comes Again.